Good afternoon. My name is Keith Peden. I work at the FDA, and I'm co-chair with Jose Esparza here. We're having a very interesting session today. It's supposed to be 20 minutes each presentation. We're trying to have 15-minute talk plus 5 minutes for questions, and we'll try and keep us all to time. The idea is that they're really going to present summaries of work, and they're going to tell us where we are in their respective fields and perhaps where we're going to go, which is interesting. So let's start today. Dr. Glenda Gray is going to talk about phase 2B trials.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Yeah. Okay, I'd like to thank the conference organizers for inviting me to do this talk. And I think that my talk is truly cross-cutting because I'm going to go from the rationale of phase 2B trials and look at some of the trial designs, and then look at, because we may use viral load as surrogate endpoints in phase 2B trials, so look at some of the natural history of viral load in different regions of the world and look at the impact of gender or age or route of infection on viral load set points. And then just to discuss briefly the HVTN 503 trial that's been conducted in South Africa. So we know that a preventive HIV vaccine should mimic the effects of natural exposure to microbes and should provide very long-lasting protection against infection and serve as a freestanding prevention method. Presently in HIV vaccine research, there is a lack of knowledge of the quality and quantity of immune responses that we require to protect against HIV infection or the development of disease. And so the features of a phase 2B test of concept vaccine trial should provide a rapid preliminary assessment of whether a vaccine concept is sufficiently promising to move forward into a phase 3 trial. So it's intended to inform stop or go decisions. Normally, it would be a randomized placebo-controlled trial in an at-risk population, and preferably a very high-risk population so you can have your endpoints met. And it should also evaluate efficacy, looking at selected endpoints, in this case probably viral load, that would augment your immunogenicity. And what's very important in these test of concept trials is to follow up people that seroconvert on vaccine trials and look at their virological and immunological outcomes, because this will inform the vaccine design in the future. And so just this slide just shows the difference between a phase 2B test of concept trial and a phase 3 pivotal design. And the most important differences are obviously around statistical power and sample size, as well as population. In a phase 2B, you're going to look at a very narrow population. You're going to go to places where there's very high risk so you can optimize your data for getting your endpoint. Primary endpoint, both in phase 2B and pivotal trials, obviously HIV infection is an endpoint and a surrogate clinical outcome as well, as measured by viral load or CD4 count. Just looking currently at the phase 2B or 3 trials that have been completed or are in process, we have the two vaccine trials which were completed that took place in Thailand and in the developed world. With around 5,400 and 2,500 participants, you can see that obviously phase 3 trials cost double the price of a phase 2B. Currently, there are 3 phase 2B trials that are ongoing. There's the two HVTN studies that are using the Merck product, one in South Africa and one in the USA, Caribbean, Latin America, and Australia. And these two trials are around 3,000 people large and are endpoint-driven trials. STEP trial is fully enrolled, and they're looking for 100 endpoints. In the HVTN-503 trial, we are about, I think, one-sixth enrolled, around 450 people, and this is amongst heterosexual men and women in South Africa. Presently, there is a 16,000 phase 2B trial run in Thailand with the Canary Pox prime boost with GP120 that is ongoing at the moment. There's also a new concept that's also been discussed, which is called the phase 2 screening test of concept trial or STOCK. And this is even a more novel approach of of trying to gather preliminary efficacy data for in a very short period of time in a few trial participants. And so a typical stock trial would go to an area that look for 30 incident HIV infections to detect a one log reduction in viral load. And for this, you would require an HIV incidence in a population of about 4%. And with 500 subjects with 18 months of follow-up, you could answer the issue of whether this is an important or promising vaccine. Just to go back to the VaxGen trials, looking at GP120, these trials were designed to look at anti-HIV neutralizing and binding antibodies, and they weren't supposed to detect a CTL response. We know that these vaccines did not prevent HIV infection, but it's very important to look at the effect of this vaccine on the natural history of HIV and to ensure that the study did not alter disease progression in any way. And also it's a very important background data because it gives us very important data on the natural history of HIV infection in this group. As you can see from the slide, that the vaccine did not impact on viral load set points or on pre-ART CD4 count, but it provides very valuable information for future trials which look at CTL responses to see whether there's any differences. So what about CTL-based vaccines? So the current portfolio of vaccines are hopefully will produce a CTL response, which we know is important for control of viremia, both in the early part of the disease and in subsequent HIV infection. And we know that we hope that a vaccine that induces a very strong T cell mediated immune response in the absence of broadly neutralizing antibodies may prove beneficial even if infection is not prevented, and that we hope that these vaccines will blunt initial viremia, prevent the early and massive destruction of memory CD4 cells, and help control infection and prolong disease-free survival. And also what's important, such a vaccine may impact on secondary transmission, and you may be able to find this out by doing community randomized trials. So these are the features of a CTL-based vaccine. And we would evaluate a CTL-based vaccine on the following parameters. We'd look at the vaccine efficacy in terms of reducing susceptibility, that is, reduce the risk of acquiring HIV infection. We'd also want to see what this vaccine did in disease progression. Only one would have to demonstrate that there was an initial reduction, that the initial reduction in viral load set point resulted in good clinical outcomes. You'd also want to see the durability of the T cell response. And obviously, again, you want to demonstrate that this vaccine reduces secondary transmission and impacts on HIV infection in the community. So if you have a look at vaccine efficacy, we'd obviously want to, as I mentioned before, reduce peak viremia, impact on the viral load set point, improve CD4 counts and maintain CD4 counts, cause viral load to be reduced for a long time and reduce and increase the time to initiate HART. And thanks to Peggy Johnson with a beautiful review in the NEJM, just to look at the hypothetical response, what we hope to see in a CTL-based vaccine. And you can see what we hope will happen is that there will be a decrease in the window of vulnerability, the smaller burst of viremia, less seeding into and destruction of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, and a very small amount of HIV in reservoirs being established, which will hopefully delay the time to progression to AIDS or death. One of the clinical surrogates that one would use is viral load, and it's very important to try and understand how viral load as a measure of efficacy may be affected by things like gender, age, subtype of virus, the region where the infection occurs, HLA, and the route of infection. I'm going to discuss mostly the impact of viral load on gender and age, look at some of the natural history data coming out of different parts of the world. I'm not going to do too much. I'm not going to do anything on host immune response. Hopefully Bruce Walker will do it, and then look at some issues around route of infection. Sorry. This is a very important slide to try and understand the impact of virus infection on the immune system. And you can see that very early on after seroconversion or after time of onset of symptoms, within about 7 to 10 days, peak viremia is reached. A nadir is then attained at around 76 to 100 days after seroconversion, and usually this nadir predicts viral load and CD4 counts at 6 to 12 months of age. Also, you see that in just after symptoms of seroconversion, your CD4 count is low, and then it increases and reaches a nadir at around 30 to 40 days after infection. If you look at the natural history of HIV infection by region and subtype, you'll see that there obviously are some problems with the data because people were using different assays. Some were using BDNA, some were using Roche Amplicor. The time to seroconversion was blurred, but basically based on taking into account all these factors and limitations, it's important to try and ascertain whether we could predict what time to AIDS would be in different studies. Looking at some of the data coming out of Europe, around 6% of people in a seroconverter study in France had undetectable viremia even without heart, and these undetectable viremia were maintained for about a year, around 11.1 months. Females were more likely to have this undetectable viremia, and people with high baseline CD4 counts and low viral loads at the time of seroconversion. Looking at a larger group of people in the Cascade collaboration, also around 7% of people having a spontaneous control of viral load and CD4 count. Women again, people without symptomatic infection, and people with high viral loads. I mean, high CD4 counts and low viral loads at baseline. Again, the median duration of undetectable virus in these cohorts was around 11 months. If you look at the effect of subtype or region on median set points and viral loads, you can see that data coming out of Brazil as compared to US men and women, you can see that men in Brazil who seroconvert seem to have similar viral loads to men in the US, but their CD4 counts declined at a much rapid rate. If you have a look at the data in the US, you can see that women do have lower viral loads than men, even though their time to AIDS is similar, which implies that women progress to AIDS much quicker, at a lower viral load than men in a similar region. If you have a look at some of the work coming out of Asia, you can see again that although the initial viral loads look similar to those coming out of the US, it seems that men in Asia they tended to increase to age much quicker. In the TAR study, the median age to AIDS was about 7.4 years, as compared to data coming out of the developed world, where it says the median age of progression to AIDS is around 11 years. Also, in India, the viral load trajectory was much steeper than it was seen in the developed world. Looking at Africa with different subtypes, you can see that viral load set points seem to be similar, and that even though there seems to be a reduction low CD4 counts in Ethiopia, in fact, survival time or time to AIDS was similar as seen in the developed world. So you can see we need a lot more data to look at the effect of region or subtype on disease progression. This slide just shows that if in men and women with high viral loads at baseline, their progression to age is higher, and also that the older you are, particularly if you're a man, the quicker you will progress to AIDS. Having a look at some of the data coming out of gender, age, and route of infection, you can see from this slide that men who have sex with men will have higher peak viral loads, higher set points, and will have much higher viral loads than men and female women. Also you can see the effect of age on viral load, set points, and progression to AIDS. Also, just looking at just a quick slide to show you that the impact of age, men who have sex with men who seroconverted at a much older age tend to have high set points as measured at 10 months after seroconversion. So let's get on in my last 2 minutes. I've only got 2 months left. Let's get on to the Pambili or Phase 2B HIV vaccine trial that has been conducted in South Africa. This trial started at the beginning of this year, and we, as I mentioned before, we hope to enroll around 3,000 people. The important part of the study is there will be a lot of women enrolled, so we'll get a good indication of the effect of this vaccine and also of natural history in South African women. And so basically, obviously, we try to make sure that this vaccine is safe and tolerable, and we're looking at two co-primary endpoints. One is an infection endpoint, and one is a viral load endpoint. And we're looking to see whether the CMR responses elicited by this vaccine will prevent persistent HIV infection and control HIV replication if infection does occur. We're also interested in the impact of pre-existing immunity to adeno-5 on the immunogenicity, and also because this is a clade C area, what the impact of a clade B vaccine is and whether a clade B vaccine can confer protection in a clade C area. And so in conclusion, my last 0 minutes, I'd like to just say that a phase 2B test of concept trials are very important to move the field forward. It'll help us to decide to go on to pivotal trials or to go back to the drawing board. And that the phase 2B test of concept trials are important because it'll provide further data that is lacking on viral dynamics in early infection. And furthermore, phase 2B test of concept trials will further elucidate the interaction between the virus and the immune system that will inform vaccine design and development in the future. And I'd like to thank particularly Peggy Johnston for her lovely review in the NEJM, the HVTN 503 investigators, and Guy James and Iftikhar here from our unit. Thanks very much.
Are there any questions? If you could come to the microphone and state your name and institution, that would be good. So our next speaker is Dr. Dennis Burton. He's going to tell us a bit about neutralizing antibodies.
Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for the chance to talk. So I'm really talking about where are we in terms of antibodies. And I'll do that quite broadly in quite a summary fashion. So the way I look at it, there's basically two major highly related questions we're addressing in the neutralizing antibody field. One is what specificities and levels of antibodies provide benefit on HIV exposure, and how do we develop immunogens that achieve and sustain these levels? And if you ask where we are now, I think we're pretty good on understanding that the antibodies we want are broadly neutralizing antibodies, and we have a pretty good handle on what the specificities of many of those antibodies are. There's been a recent upsurge of enthusiasm for non-neutralizing antibodies. I personally don't share that enthusiasm. I think that non-neutralizing antibodies could contribute, could provide some benefit, but in the absence of neutralizing antibodies, I don't think they will do that particularly effectively. The levels is still a major issue that we're grappling with, and there are ongoing studies there. So in the absence of really understanding what levels will provide benefit, especially in the context of robust cellular immune responses, which we hope we're going to get in a vaccine, we really focus on problem number two and reduce that to understanding how can we design immunogens that elicit broadly neutralizing antibodies and not worry too much at this stage about levels. So all neutralizing antibodies against HIV target the envelope trimer, and broadly neutralizing antibodies can target conserved exposed regions on this trimer. And there are basically, I would say, three major strategies of immunogen design that are in operation today. The first, and I'll go through these quite quickly. So the first would be trimer mimics. And here, the great problem, and this is a problem that relates, that distinguishes HIV vaccines from others, the great problem is that the envelope trimer is very unstable. And so one needs to find some way to stabilize it, and this is what is done in many recombinant preparations. However, nobody has yet achieved good stabilization of the trimer and good mimicry of the trimer as it appears on the viral surface, despite intense efforts from labs such as Sadrovsky and Moore and so on. So, and I think that one of the things that everyone's waiting for is a structure of the trimer, a crystal structure of the trimer, that would allow us to more exquisitely design these stabilized recombinant trimers. And hopefully that's going to be on the way in the next 2 or 3 years or so. Certainly we're getting better and better views of the trimer with, for example, cryo-EM, but we do need the high resolution of a crystal structure, I think, to really design these mimics. The next approach would be entry intermediates, where one's essentially most likely trying to target the co-receptor site. And the problem here seems to be one of accessibility. The co-receptor site, highly conserved, is exposed during viral entry to some degree, but the exposure occurs in the context of two membranes and is limited, and it does not appear from most of the data that the amount of space that's provided is sufficient for whole antibodies to gain access. So this approach has kind of died a little bit amongst some in recent years, although some are still pursuing it. And then the third approach is epitope mimics, which essentially is to produce epitope mimics of the broadly neutralizing antibodies determined from structural studies on complexes. And the basic idea is fairly straightforward. So what one seeks to do is one has knowledge of the broadly neutralizing antibodies. One seeks to gain information, molecular information, on the interaction of these antibodies with envelope, and then use this information to design immunogens. And that's there's a lot of effort ongoing in this area at the present time. And what I'll do is just run through the various broadly neutralizing epitopes and discuss what's ongoing in very few slides. So let me begin with the CD4 site, which is the natural target in a way for antibody vaccine development. It is a region that's clearly pretty highly conserved. The virus has got to remain CD4 tropic. So the site needs to be relatively well conserved and accessible at least to CD4. But over many years now, the only evidence that we've had that this is a vaccine target has been this single monoclonal antibody B12. Now, there has been a great advance there from Peter Kwong's lab this year in February, in that Peter published the crystal structure of a complex of B12 with the core of GP120. And this, for the first time, provided us with molecular view of this broadly neutralizing epitope. And so the race is now on, and that's the yellow color here. I don't actually know how to point at this. I have to turn to that one, yeah, which you're always told not to do, right? But you can see the yellow color there, and we have that in molecular detail now. So the race is on to try and take that molecular detail and design that, build that into another molecule. And an example of this would be the work ongoing from Bill Schief, Gary Nabel, and Peter Kwong, where they're trying to scaffold the binding site. So if you look here at B12, this is B12, you'll see that there are two loops in yellow that are particularly well that are the core of the binding site. And what Bill Schief has done is to design scaffolded molecules that present those cores, those loops on different scaffolds. And there's now the possibility of in vitro evolution of these molecules and ultimately of testing as immunogens. And there's a lot of interest in whether this scaffolding type of approach can work for vaccinology generally. At the same time, Personally, I think an important development has been the realization that there are other antibodies out there than B12 that are broadly neutralizing that target the CD4 binding site. So this is some work from our lab which shows two sera that you'll see the green color indicates neutralization, and there are a large number of different viruses shown in this table from different clades and different parts of the world. And these sera are very broadly neutralizing. They're from donors who've been infected in the early to mid-80s. And we fractionated the sera and have tried to determine the specificities of this neutralization. And we've been partially successful in showing that much of the neut is GP120 reactive. It's not directed to the V3 loop. It's not directed to the GP41 broadly neutralizing epitopes. And we suggested it might be directed to the CD4 binding site. Now, a beautiful piece of work has been carried out and is in press now from Rich Wyatt and John Mascola, showing for two donors, indeed, broad neutralization can be assigned to the CD4 binding site. And so, in brief, what they did was to fractionate the sera with wild-type GP120, and then also fractionate it with a mutant GP120, a D368R mutant that does not bind CD4 binding site antibodies. So they had these two possibilities, and the results were very clear for... I don't know what to say. There we go. So if you look at... We'll just look at patient one... Then if you look at the control beads, there's the neutralization curve, pretty good. And then if you deplete with wild-type GP120, you can essentially deplete virtually, the 90-odd percent of the neutralizing activity with the wild-type beads. If you use the mutant beads, nothing. Very strongly indicating that the specificity that you're looking at is directed to the CD4 binding site. And they did many, many different experiments that suggested the same thing. One experiment that is complementary is that they actually eluted the fraction that bound to GP120 and showed that that was highly effective at neutralization against a resistant virus that was not neutralized by B12. So for the first time now, we have... strong indications of broadly neutralizing antibodies directed to the CD4 binding site as well as B12. And I think that's a very significant development. Let me move on to the glycan shield. So there is this antibody 2G12, which Dan Calaresi in Ian Wilson's lab showed was a domain exchanged antibody. And he determined the structure with its sugar ligand, the GluCNAC2-MAN9. And we can then model this structure on the spikes. And you can see here, if this will just stretch, that what we're looking at is the recognition, if we combine crystallographic and biochemical data, of an array of three MAN9s on the envelope spike as being the binding site. So the vaccine protocol now is to try and take that array of sugars and reproduce it and use that to try and elicit this sort of antibody. And there's a couple of approaches that people are adopting. Raymond Dweck's lab in Oxford is looking for natural presentations of this sugar, and they found a few. One is on Candida albicans. It's not exactly the same as HIV, but it's very similar, and it does bind 2G12 quite well, and they're immunizing with these. An alternative approach that we have followed with Chi-Wei Wong's lab, Will Greenberg, MG Finn, and Ian Wilson is synthetic, so try and synthesize these sugars and put them in multivalent presentations. And these are two examples of quite successful presentations where we have reproduced the glycan shield sufficiently well that we can achieve good 2G12 binding. You'll see the first one expresses 279 copies of this MAN9 on Q-beta, a phage. And the other one uses an oligodendron arrangement to present a large number of MAN9s on BSA. And both of these arrangements Now, wholly synthetic arrangements bind 2G12 with nanomolar affinities, and they're being investigated as immunogens. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about the MPER, which is the final a broadly neutralizing epitope, with a number of antibodies targeting it. The first two, both from Hermann Kattinger, 2F5 and 4E10, you'll note that both of them recognize epitopes very close to the membrane. 2F5 recognizes a rather extended peptide epitope, as determined by Peter Kwong, and 4E10 recognizes a helical epitope, as determined by Rosa Cardoso in Ian Wilson's lab. Now, there are a number of different attempts to reproduce these peptide epitopes. Bill Schief is and Rich Wyatt and Peter Kwong are doing this in a number of epitope scaffolds, as you'll see here. We took a look at trying to engraft this epitope, this helical epitope, into the V1-V2 loop of GP120, reasoning that this was quite an immunogenic site. And what Mansoon Law did was to move the register of the helix, so he kind of turned the helix round in the V1-V2 loop to give different constructs. So we know that the antibody is only going to recognize one side of the helix, so we turn it around and present it in these different fashions. However, although we could get very good binding of 4E10 to these constructs, when we immunized both rabbits and mice, we got no 4E10-like antibodies. And there are a number of possible explanations for this. One would be that, argued originally by Bartains, of tolerance. Another would be the hydrophobicity of the helical epitope, that this is a very hydrophobic region, and perhaps when you put it into an animal, it just finds something else hydrophobic and sticks to it, and it's not there exposed to the system anymore. And then there are other possibilities that I won't go into. I'm only 2 minutes away. Just on this issue of tolerance, many of you will be aware of this paper from Bart that argues that these antibodies are prohibited by tolerance, that they are anti-cardiolipin antibodies. We don't agree with that, and we have Aaron Shearer will present an oral abstract on this if you're interested at this meeting. This is my last slide. Just to emphasize that what I'm talking about here is an attempt at rational vaccine design that goes through a molecular understanding of antibody recognition of the viral envelope. And the more antibodies, broadly neutralizing antibodies, that we can put in on the left-hand side here, and the more rapidly we can screen these on the right, the more rapidly this, I think, will arrive at some kinds of candidates that elicit useful levels of neutralizing antibodies. I mentioned there are many, many people in the work that I showed. Hopefully I mentioned them. I'd just like to particularly acknowledge the financial support of NIAID and of IRV. And I'll finish there. Thank you.
Any questions for Dennis Burton?
Dennis, I wonder if you could elaborate in your comment about this recent interest in non-neutralizing antibodies. And certainly, antibody has other functions, some of them mediated by the Fc,
yeah,
such as ADCC. And they may contribute, not by themselves, but maybe they contribute to build a barrier to infection.
Right. Well, as you know, we have done some work that shows that Fc receptor binding seems to be crucial for the anti-protective activity of a neutralizing antibody. But if you have non-neutralizing antibodies, then basically, as we understand it, generally their activity will be much diminished compared to neutralizing, because they're binding to non-functional forms of envelope. Now, they may... You know, there are shed GP120, so there's GP120 GP41 stumps, and you could bind to those, and you could hope that that might help you clear virus. I mean, those are possibilities, but, you know, we have the Vaxgen trial where we had lots of non-neutralizing antibodies and there wasn't much protection. We have other studies that we did in SCID mice where with neutralizing antibodies we got protection, but with none we did not. And also, you know, some of John Mascola's studies with low levels of neutralizing antibodies that were not protective. So, and generally speaking, viral protection is much, much better with neutralizing antibodies, almost without exception, I would argue. I don't know if anybody wants to argue that, but...
So Dennis, while someone else is coming up, those broadly neutralizing antibodies, you've looked at a whole series of X4 as well as R5 viruses?
Yes. Yeah, no real difference in neutralizing ability.
Dennis, there's many, many hyaluronidase residues on GP120. What's special about those that induce 2G12?
Well, I mean, just let me say, I mean, I don't actually know that they induce 2G12. We never know, but they certainly bind to them. What's special about them is the arrangement, is that it seems that if you have single... we know quite a lot more about this now because we've put synthetic mannose onto different scaffolds. And so we did that with cowpea mosaic virus. And it turned out there we got lots of groups of two MAN9s, but we never had three or four. And there we got no 2G12 binding, however much we put on. It was only with the Q-beta when we had these groups of three and four. So I think you need these three of three and four. And it might be four. It might be that it's binding three, but the other one is nearby and it's stopping the arrangement flopping about. And I think that's only found once on GP120 generally. Although Raymond Dweck has also shown that if you treat with kifenensin, and then you can produce GP120 that's all oligomannose, then you have more 2G12 sites. You have two or even three. So,
yeah, regarding the synthetic MAN9 vaccine candidates, is there not a danger that you might also elicit an immune response to glycoproteins that have a MAN9?
Well, yeah, I think the answer to that would sort of be related to the first question, which would be that they will not recognize single mannose. And as far as we know, the only time that this cluster of mannose occurs is on GP120 and certain pathogens like Candida, and there's a Shigella that has it.
There's no evidence for that in mammals at all.
Sorry?
There's no evidence for those combinations.
No, there's no human protein that binds 2G12 that we've been aware of.
Thank you.
Along the same lines, Dennis, I believe it was your lab that showed several years ago that escape from 2G12 might be fairly easy to achieve,
yeah,
simply by removal of or changing of one of the amino acids so that you get fewer of the mannose side chains. But yet you still seem to think that this is a reasonable target for
sure,
trying to elicit antibodies.
Yeah. I mean, I think the those experiments, and you know, now you can add on Alexandra's experiments, Trukola's experiments, and Marty Markovitz, where, you know, if you treat with 2G12, the escape will happen just like that by simply, you know, losing one of the sugars. But the difference is, when you're doing protection, the antibody's there before the virus, and there isn't all that great diversity, and you're probably protecting against a very small diversity of species. That would be my argument, but there's data for that in that John Mascola has shown that 2G12 is very good at protection, So, you know, I think protection is very, very different from established infection. That would be my argument.
I have a question for you. With regard to the data that have been produced in a paper a couple of years ago in Natural Medicine using this cocktail from cutting to treat patient during primary infection.
That's Alexandra Trukola. Yeah.
Alexandra Trukola paper. Now, it is clear that since there was a very good control, at least transient, but there was a good control, then these epitopes are exposed. then the, in principle they are exposed, but from one reason or the other, they are not highly immunogenic. And also now there are people that using the reverse vaccinology approach, particularly also Antonio Lanzavecchia is working a lot on this. And then even using blood from long-term non-progressor, you know, is having really hard time to isolate, you know, B cells that are able to produce neutralizing antibody. Then, you know, the issue is it is only the fact that are not exposed or poorly exposed, or there is also an issue with really poor immunogenicity, because the frequency of B cells for these epitopes is very, very, very low compared to other viruses.
Actually, I think Antonio is having a couple of successes recently, but further to that, you are right. I mean, the immunogenicity of these epitopes is very low, but that's in the context of the virus that has evolved just for that purpose. It cannot tolerate having high titers of anti-MPER antibodies, but that doesn't mean to say that when we present those epitopes in the environments that we do, that we can't change immunogenicity completely. I mean, that happens all the time with, you know, peptide epitopes and so on. So what we're trying to do is to rewrite immunogenicity by our design.
Give my to Dr. Erspas.
Yeah, I'll speak from here. So as Denny described, the developing of vaccines that induce neutralizing or protective antibodies is one of the major challenges that the field is confronting, and we certainly look forward to see progress in the future. But most vaccines that are currently in clinical trials are designed to induce cell-mediated immunity. So J.P. Pantaleo from Lausanne will tell us everything about vector-based vaccines in 15 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe 16 minutes. Okay. First of all, I would like to thank the organizer. And then I have been asked to give some overview on vector-based vaccine, particularly limiting to data originated from phase one clinical trials. Now, with regard to the different concepts that have been developed, as you see, there are a number. The one that, as was just mentioned by Jose, that in the HIV field are really, you know, have been mostly developed are those using vectors, various vectors-based vaccine and the DNA. Then I'm going to limit my talk to these two different strategies. Now, this is, you know, a list of the different clinical trials that you can find on the IAVI website. This is the source data. And then the point that I want to make, and then there are several, three, four pages, is the most comprehensive, you know, list of phase one vaccine trial. And what you will see is that practically we are talking exclusively about trials performed with adenovirus-based vaccine and with the poxvirus-based vaccine, and then complemented or not with DNA. Then, despite there are a quite large number, maybe, of other vectors in preclinical, but in clinical, most of the phase one clinical trials are really focus on the use of adenovirus and the poxvirus-based vaccine complement with DNA. There are some interesting also phase one trial addressing new adjuvants. Particularly, there are, I want to underscore, some trials using some DNA expressing IL-15 or IL-12. These IL-15 and IL-12 are the important cytokines involved in maturation of T cells and also in directing T cell responses towards TH1 T cell responses. But as I said, most of these trials, they are using all the same type of virus vectors. Now, let me give you some background about the adenovirus. Then there are 51 serotypes identified that are classified in six groups. And then generally in healthy individuals, they cause a self-limiting disease. For this reason, as you know, there is no drug for the adenovirus infection. In contrast, adenovirus infection can be pathogenic in individuals who are compromised, HIV-infected individuals, bone marrow transplanted patients, and also children. Now, the adeno5 is the most common used adenovector in gene therapy and vaccination, and then it has been rendered to be incompetent through the deletion of the E1 gene. It has an excellent safety record, it is easy to manipulate, and then also it is able to, we can establish, you know, insert, you know, have expression of inserted transgene, and then it is highly immunogenic. Now, what is the immunologic basis for using adenovirus? It comes from original studies performed by the Merck group, John Shiver, and collaborators, and also from Norm Letvin and Gary Nabel's group. And then it was initially shown that, in fact, these vectors were able to induce effective antiviral immunity. And also a more recent paper was showing that immunizing monkeys with these vectors expressing SIV genes, we could preserve the initial depletion of CD4 central memory cells. Now, with regard to the adenovirus vector that is in, as you have heard from Glenda Gray, in the phase 2B trial, these trials have been kindly provided by Danny Casimiro and Mike Robertson. You see, it's a trivalent vaccine expressing GAG-POL and NF. It has been engineered to be replication defective through the deletion of E1AB, and also to be genetically stable, a manufacturer product. It is produced in a cell line, which is PERSI-6, that eliminates reversion to wild type, and the formulation is 1-1-1 with 4 GAG, POL, and NF, with a dose of 3 times 10 to the 10 total virus particle. And this is the vaccine that, as you have heard, is in phase 2B trial. Now, with regard to immunogenicity data, this slide gives me the opportunity to, however, raise an issue with regard to adenovirus-based vaccine. As you can see here, there are 3 different concentrations, more or less induce the same level of immunogenicity, which is in the range of 300 spot-forming units per 10 to the 6 blood mononuclear cells, as measured by interferon gamma ELISpot assay. But what you can see, the bold bullets, they are the black bullets, they are the individuals, volunteers, with antibody titers for adenovirus below 200, and then the empty bullets are the volunteers with antibody titers greater than 200. And then you can see, however, that in these studies there is a tendency of the concentration of the responders in individuals with antibody titers below. Therefore, there is an issue about the pre-existing immunity with the adenovirus. In part, and then you can see also when they have looked at the longevity of the response, you can see that in the volunteers that have lower titer of antibodies in blue, they generally have a better, we have a better percentage of responder in this group as compared to those who have higher antibody titers here in pink. Now, one of the strategies that has been used by the Vaccine Research Center is to prime these individuals with DNA and then to boost with adeno in order also to minimize this pre-existing immunity, but also this strategy has been different from the adenovirus program from the Vaccine Research Center. In fact, they have included multiple subtypes, and then, as I said, they've used a combination approach using DNA plus plus adeno. And these are the slides kindly provided by Rick Kaup from the VRC. And then, as you can see, it's a quite, at the same time, complex vaccine regimen, which involves the production of 10 different products, 3 DNA expressing the different clades A, B, and C, 3 DNA expressing individually GAG, POL, and NF from clade B, and then with regard to the recombinant adeno5, 3 adeno expressing A, B, and C, and then 1 expressing GAG, POL. And then the vaccine regimen involves 3 immunizations with DNA, at month 0, 1, and 2, and then a boost with adeno at month 6. Now, these are just cumulative data. Just concentrate your attention on the DNA prime adeno 5 boost. And what you can see here, that the response against envelope is in, there is a median number of spot forming units per 10 to the 6 cells in the range of 300 per 10 to the 6 cells, whereas the responses against GAG and POL are present but are a little bit lower in 100, median 100 with for GAG and then about 50 spot forming units per POL. Now, as I said, there is potentially a problem with persisting immunity. For this reason, there is a line of research that is looking at different strategies to overcome the issue of persisting immunity. And then this is centering on the development of novel adenovirus vector. And then the goal is to develop novel vectors with the same immunogenicity of adeno 5, with the serologic profile of rare adenovirus serotypes, and which also have large-scale manufacturability. And then the two key strategies that have been identified are novel serotype recombinant adenovectors and novel chimeric. Now, this data that I'm going to show you have been provided by Dan Barouche. Here you can see the comparative adenovirus seroprevalence in adults from sub-Saharan Africa. You can see that the higher titer of antibodies are against adenovirus 5. However, there are a number of other serotypes, particularly 35, 26, 48. As you can see, you know, most of the titers are very, very low, below 16. This data generated by Dan Barouche, in my mind, are very exciting. This is showing what is the immunogenicity of a chimeric adeno 5, adeno 48, or adeno 26 in monkeys with pre-existing anti-adeno 5 immunity. As you can see, there is a substantial increase in the immunogenicity that seems to be independent from the presence of persisting anti-adeno 5 immunity. And also another extremely interesting piece of data is this one showing that actually you can use some of these rare serotypes such as adeno 26 in order to prime adeno 5 responses. As you can see here, you have an increase of about fivefold of the response of the immunogenicity of adeno 26 plus adeno 5 using adeno 26 as a prime. Now, let's move now to the pox viruses, and most of the development has been done of viruses originating from vaccinia virus. And the two that are most commonly used are the modified vaccinia Ankara and also the some derivative from the vaccinia virus Copenhagen. Now, why there is so much attention on pox viruses? There is a broad or strange are easy to generate recombinants. There is a robust production process available. They are able to induce both human and cell immune response and then excellent safety records. Now, something these slides I put up because sometimes we say that these three viruses are exactly the same, the most commonly used, but as you can see, the origin of these viruses is very different. The vaccinia, the MVA, has been only generated through passages 571 in a chicken embryo fibroblast. In contrast, the NIVAC has been generated through a massive deletion of 18 genes that are involved in virulence and pathogenicity. And then the canary pox, the one that is used which ALVAC has originated using the phase 3 trial in Thailand, has been originated, attenuated through 200 passages in chicken embryo fibroblast cells. And these viruses are quite different from one to the other in terms of the attenuation process. NIVAC is the one that I will show you some data that we are using. I will not go through. And then these are the data that we have generated in the Eurovac 2 trial. This is a phase one trial. Now this vaccine combination has entered in phase two, and then a trial in recruiting 150 persons has already started a couple of weeks ago in different centers in Europe. And then the data, this trial, we compared the immunogenicity of two immunization of DNA plus two NIVAC immunization versus NIVAC alone. They are expressing FCAG pollen F from plate C. These are the Eurovac, you know, insert. It's a monovalent vaccine for NIVAC. The same construct express FCAG pollen F. And then is a divalent vaccine for DNA. We have two plasmid DNA, one expressing DNA envelope, the other GAC-POL-NEF. Now, these are the immunogenicity data. 90% of responders at the primary endpoint, which is weeks 26, 28, 2 weeks, 4 weeks after the last vaccination. The response remains, as you see, very high over time. These are the individual data of the responders, but if we look at the cumulative data, you can see that the median of spot forming units per 10 to the 6 blood-borne nuclear cells is in the range of 300, which is you know, exactly comparable to what it has been shown with the DNA plus adeno or with the adeno alone. There is also a response against GAC-POL-NEF, which is in a similar range of about 100 spot-forming units, and this response is also present in 50% of individuals in addition to envelope. What about the functional profile? I think that based on our knowledge of immune correlates, as we will hear a little while from Bruce, is the best that we can expect, we can hope. It's a polyfunctional responses for CD4. These CD4 T cells induced by the vaccine immunization, they secrete IL-2, TNF-alpha, they proliferate in response to the peptide. The same is for CD8. In addition, they also, we can show the presence of the granulation activity, which is a measure of cytotoxic activity. And then the breadth of the response, there is a mean number of 4 epitopes recognized per volunteer. And then mostly of these epitopes are CD4 epitopes, but we have also identified a new HLA-1 restricted CD8 epitopes. The durability of the response, these responses are highly durable, as you can see. As 1 year after the infection, 1 year and a half, still the response are there. And then the conclusion then, I think that what the vector that are currently under development, they have shown to be highly immunogenic, to have induced a vigorous response. These responses are polyfunctional, they are durable. Now, what is the future? Now, in my mind, and then I strongly support, you know, the initiative from the IAVI regarding the symposium that was organized, because I think that the future of this virus vector-based vaccine, now that have been shown to be safe, is to move versus replication-competent you know, virus vectors. A number of these vectors are already in preclinical studies. And then I think that one of the possibility of developing replication competent vectors is to simplify the immunization regimen, which today are very complex, to induce more balanced CD4 and T-cell responses, as it has been shown for live replication competent attenuated vaccine already available, improve the durability of the T-cell responses, and then most also very important is to reduce the cost and also to the problem associated with large-scale manufacturing. Now, the last slide is to acknowledge the people within the Eurovac consortium that I have shown you the data, and also recap from the Vaccine Research Center that kindly provided the slides, and also other people contributed to this presentation, Danny Casimiro and Mike Robertson from Merck, Jaap Kusmit and Katerina Radosevic from Crusell, and Dan Baruch from Harvard Medical School. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeppe. This presentation is open for discussion.
I'm just wondering whether or not you have done any or not any information about Tetrava in terms of the memory T cell repertoire and also in terms of the mucosal immunity, any information about this vaccine and whether or not cells could be recruited to this site?
Yeah, there was a piece of data, in one slide using tetramer that we can, at least for the CD8 cell responses, we have developed some tetramers, and then we can monitor very well the response. With regard to the type of T cells that are induced by this type of immunization, there is a very extensive characterization of the type of memory T cell response. And then with regard to CD8 T cells, these T cells, they have a phenotype which is RA positive and CCR7 negative, which is typical of long-lived T cells. With regard to the mucosal immunity, we have not tested. We have not performed biopsy in these volunteers in order to determine whether or not T cells were also present at the mucosal level.
My question is, do you have any animal protection data within NIVAC? And yeah. Maybe many years ago, people actually used NIVAC or other vaccine for animal protection, but I don't know if your construct has been tested in an animal model.
Well, we have a parallel analysis and use of this combination in both immunogenicity and protection data in the monkey model. And then, in fact, is highly protective. For what these, monkey models, are important. But, induces complete protection, this immunization scheme, also in monkeys. There is a paper that is submitted about this data. Now, with regard to the NIVAC, I think that, what is important to keep in mind is that it's not only the vector, but also the antigens. And then I think that it has been used, in the past for cancer vaccine, NIVAC. Then probably, the only explanation that I have that it is possible that the antigens that were inserted were not highly immunogenic. But based on the data that we have, it seems to be really an extremely promising, pox virus candidate.
Any questions? Because we have some time, let me ask another question.
Yeah.
JP, those vectors are not just mechanical carriers of a foreign gene. Pox viruses are very complex viruses, and they have many genes that can actually modulate the immune response.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can tell us what is that you're doing to improve.
Well, the future, about this. The future, I think that it's a good point. Well, there is... Now there is an entire program that is funded, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation about development of more immunogenic, pox viruses. And there is, there are two strategies, in fact. One is through the modification, the deletion of some genes expressed by pox viruses that are known to be immunosuppressive. And then the second strategy is to develop some replication competent, pox virus. And then I think that in my mind, if we are able to combine the two, I think that we are going to be in the situation of probably, using only one, vaccine and not having also the need to prime with DNA, which definitely, adds a lot of complexity to these vaccine regimens.
Any other question? If not, we'll move. The holy grail of vaccinology is to identify the immune response or immune responses that confer protection in vaccinated individuals. And we have some clues from animal protection experiments and also from HIV-infected people who somehow control infection. And in the last presentation of today, Bruce Walker from Harvard will brief us on correlates of protective immunity. Bruce.
Yeah, thanks very much. I want to thank also the organizers for inviting me. So I'm going to talk about CD8 T cell responses and try and be a little bit provocative about where we need to go and what the focus should be. So basically, the problem that we're all trying to deal with in terms of vaccines is how do you prevent cells from making more viruses? The more they make, the worse people are going to do. And so this is really the issue. And the question is, how can you limit virus replication? The important point to remember is that we're dealing right now with the sort of realization that the first generation vaccines are going to be vaccines that allow infection to occur. So we're going to be in a situation where we're going to have to limit the amount of virus that's produced by an infected cell. So there are ways to do this. Neutralizing antibodies can do it. And what we've pursued is induction of antibodies that neutralize infectious virus. So basically what's guided development thus far in terms of neutralizing antibodies is trying to look at those antibodies that actually have an effect on the ability of virus to replicate, because at the end of the day, that's really the issue. And we really have not particularly pursued antibodies that don't appear to have any function that we can measure. In terms of vaccine development for CTL, I guess the question I'll ask is, are we essentially measuring the equivalent of binding antibodies with the current assays that we're doing? And I think this isn't a question that just I am asking, but lots of people are asking. You know, we do these assays where we're not looking at infectious virus. What we're looking at are cells with a bunch of synthetic peptide plastered on their cell surface that is not physiologic. And then we look at interferon gamma production, which basically tells you that some interaction is happening at the surface of that cell when you have a cell that has a bunch of peptide plastered on the surface. You can make this more complicated by looking at other things that might get tickled to be produced by a cell, and you can start looking at polyfunctional responses. But again, that doesn't really tell you a function that's actually having something to do with limiting virus replication. It just tells you that cell's getting tickled and some cytokines being produced. So the question is, can we think about this in a more functionally relevant manner and try and look at the issue of virus production by infected cells? And in fact, there is a way to do this if you, instead of looking at synthetic peptides, you actually look at infected cells. Now, why is that important? Well, there are a whole bunch of steps that are completely skipped when you do an ELISpot type assay. The process of infection, of antigen processing and presentation, binding to class 1, presentation to the cell surface in a physiologically relevant amount, and then not only recognition by CTL, but also killing by CTL, where the measurement then is the inhibition of virus production as a measure of efficacy. So let me pose some hypotheses here. The ability to inhibit virus replication is important. Current ELISpot assays really give no indication of this ability. The hypothesis is that, in fact, we can identify CTL responses that neutralize infectious virus, and that vaccine induction of these responses is going to be key for current vaccine strategies. So let's take a situation where we have somebody who's spontaneously controlling virus, a so-called elite controller, and let's look at the ability of their cells to inhibit virus replication rather than just doing a simple ELISpot assay. And so what you do here is, in this particular experiment, it's based on some studies that Otto Yang had done 10 years ago, you expand their CD8 cells just so you have enough of them to put in this assay. You infect their CD4 cells with HIV. It's actually easy to do in these patients because if you just stimulate their CD4 cells, they don't produce autologous virus, so you exogenously infect with a virus, and then you look to see if you can inhibit replication. So basically this is the use anti-CD3 to just get a kind of a representative expansion of the cell specificities that are there. And then you put them in this virus neutralization assay, and what you see is somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000-fold reduction in virus replication by those cells over a 7 to 10-day course of infection. So that's a huge amount of neutralization in an assay where you're actually measuring what I think is something functionally relevant. Well, then, if you've got a way to measure that, then you can start to dissect this in the same way that Dennis was talking about with antibodies. We can sort of elute different kinds of antibodies by their specificity and see what is it that's important in terms of mediating this. What I just showed you were bulk CD8 cells showing really profound inhibition of virus replication. well, what if you now just try and elute out specificities and measure those to see what happens? Well, let's do that first for a GAG-specific clone, just deriving a CTL that are specific for this KK10 epitope, which we know is relevant because if you look at people that target this particular epitope, they have a low viral load, and B27 positive individuals that don't target it have a high viral load. So with this particular assay, now you can go back and you can add that clone at a 1-to-1 ratio, or you can have one of those per 10 CD4 cells, or even one of those per 50 or 100 CD4 cells, and you can see a statistically significant inhibition of replication. And in fact, in this case, it's almost 5 logs of inhibition that you're seeing with that particular clone. That's a huge amount of inhibition. That's a huge amount of virus neutralization. Well, how specific is this inhibition? We want to test the efficacy of immune responses in a relevant fashion that will reflect what we think is going on in vivo. So let's look at variant and wild-type viruses and see if this assay can actually show us those differences. And let's also look at the issue of antigen processing mutations that would never be picked up in an ELISpot assay. And when we do this, we're looking at a wild-type epitope versus an escape epitope in KK10. What you see is that you see this huge amount of inhibition of replication on the left-hand panel when you add the clone. But if the naturally arising variant that occurs under immune selection pressure is the virus that you use now for this assay, you get no inhibition of replication, showing, in fact, that this is replicating exactly what we might expect. Well, what about if you have processing mutations? Here are 3 panels. The first panel is just wild-type virus. The second panel is a virus that has a mutation outside of the epitope, and what that does is it abrogates processing, and you get no inhibition of replication. And on the other hand, if you have a mutation there within the epitope that does not affect processing, on the third panel, you get complete inhibition. So we've got an assay now that we can feel is fairly robust. So now we can start to ask some more relevant questions in terms of vaccine development. Does virus neutralization by CTL depend on the epitope that's being targeted? Pretty fundamental question. We got a lot of effort put into making vaccines. There's only a few things that we can do. One of the things we can do in terms of designing those vaccines is decide what to put into it. Should we put the kitchen sink in, or should we be selective about what's being put in? And are some HIV antigens better than others? So here's the simple experiments that you can do now. You take somebody's PBMCs and you enrich either for GAG-specific response or an envelope-specific response by stimulating in vitro with a envelope peptide. And then you put them into the same assay and you say, do these things now that we can measure as enriched populations for envelope or enriched for GAG, do they inhibit virus replication? Now, we published a paper in January that suggested that GAG responses by ELISpot, the broader the GAG-specific response, the lower the viral load, and the broader the envelope-specific response, quite surprisingly, the higher the viral load, which was a little unsettling to us to see, because here are immune responses in the same individuals that are heading in completely different directions. Well, now we have a chance to look at the same question in a physiologically, what we think is a more physiologically relevant situation, and here's the result we get. Same HLA allele that's restricting here. On the one hand, in this individual, we've enriched for an envelope-specific response, and we don't get inhibition of replication. But when we enrich for a GAG-specific response, we get a huge amount of inhibition of replication. So that, at least in this one single incident, looks kind of like what we were seeing in this paper that we had published earlier. Well, can we take this a little bit further? So let's do that, and Huabiao Chen and our group did that by getting 14 different lines from individuals that are HIV infected for GAG and 12 for envelope, and then looked at inhibition of primary isolates, both R5 and X4 viruses. And so these are all the specificities. The only thing I'll point out is that we're matched for, we have the same restricting allele for envelope and gag specific responses in most of these individuals. And so here's one of the individuals. So all we're doing is we're enriching for the different specificities that are already present there. And look at what you see. There are huge differences in the antiviral efficacy of these different responses that are floating around. As you enrich for some, the ones in green are gag, and you get relatively better inhibition of replication than you do with the envelope-specific lines that you generate from the same individual. So these are taking all the specificities that happen to be there and just asking which of them are really mediating antiviral activity. If you look at this now in two different patients, the patient on the top against an X4 and an R5 virus, you see essentially the same thing. GAG does better than envelope. If you take a second subject down on the bottom, again, in the green are the GAG-specific responses, and the red are the envelope-specific responses. We didn't go into this with a bias. We just generated all those responses, but this is what the data basically showed. Well, you can do a statistical comparison now in terms of these outcomes by basically using something called log inhibition units, where the greater the inhibition, the higher the log inhibition units. And basically, for all four of these individuals, GAG specificity wins, envelope specificity loses. In every single one of these individuals that we've looked at, when we enriched for envelope-specific responses, we got less virus inhibition. When we enriched for GAG, we got more virus neutralization. Is a simple explanation just that we've got mutations that are arising? So let's sequence virus from every one of these patients that we looked at, and let's also sequence virus at the end of the inhibition of replication assay when you've got 10 days out, you're growing virus. Let's make sure that that's not mutated virus. And in fact, that's what we found, that the mutations would actually not explain this. And when we look on the top two panels here, just at all of the responses in general, we see a highly statistically significant difference. The GAG responses are doing much better than the envelope-specific responses. On the bottom, we've taken out those isolated cases where there's a mutation within the envelope epitope or adjacent to the envelope or GAG epitopes that only got rid of a couple of the envelope and GAG-specific responses that we were evaluating. But now with mutations completely taken out of the picture, we see the exact same thing. Well, can we confirm this in another way? Let's do this in kind of a sequential way where we progressively enrich for GAG and progressively enrich for envelope and see if we get the same effects. And in fact, here's what you see. On the left-hand panel, we're measuring the percentage of the response in the bulk cells that's GAG-specific. And you can see that as you stimulate a second time, that goes up. So you're stimulating with GAG peptides. As you enrich in the middle panel, what you see is that the log inhibition units go up as you enrich. And in fact, this is highly statistically significant. Look at what happens with envelope. On the left-hand panel, you enrich for envelope, but as you enrich for envelope, you actually get less virus inhibition, and that's highly statistically significant and goes in exactly the opposite direction of what we're seeing with GAG. So based on these data, I think we have to think about how to put these into perspective. A couple of conclusions and then some questions. The relative ability of CTL to neutralize HIV can clearly be quantitated in an in vitro assay. Whether that's relevant in vivo, I don't know, but it's certainly suggested to be relevant based on the assays that have been done and these issues about viral escape and antigen processing, where it all fits in with what we're seeing in vivo. HIV-specific CTL differ by over 1,000-fold in their ability to neutralize HIV. 1,000-fold difference in terms of their specificity, in terms of what their neutralizing activity actually is. That's a lot of difference for a response that we've generally sort of thought about as, you know, CTL or CTL, and whether it's envelope or GAG or Paul or Neff, who cares, let's get the most we can. The third conclusion is that GAG-specific CTL responses consistently neutralize better than envelope-specific responses. And perhaps more importantly, enriching for GAG-specific responses enhances neutralization, but when you enrich for envelope-specific responses, you actually diminish neutralization of virus. And this is all independent of the restricting HLA allele. I think these are very striking data. The big question is why, and is there any potential explanation for this? Is this all, something that's completely irrelevant because it's done in vitro, or is this something that really we need to think about in terms of where we're heading with vaccines? Well, in terms of why, there was a really terrific paper published by David Watkins and a postdoc of his, Jonas Sasha, basically showing that when virus gets into a cell, there's preformed GAG protein in that virion. And that preformed GAG protein can immediately be taken up into an antigen processing pathway and presented at the cell surface. It doesn't have to undergo de novo protein synthesis. But for other things like envelope, before a cell is sensitized for recognition, you have to first generate those proteins through de novo protein synthesis. So that's at least one potential explanation for this. I think another potential explanation is that envelope is just very, very plastic and tolerates a lot of mutability. And so that during the inductive phase of the immune response, if mutations are arising, you may never have a constant enough antigen to be looking at to really get the same kind of affinity maturation that you get with, for example, GAG-specific responses. But there are a lot of unanswered questions right now. How relevant is this in vivo? I think we don't know. What are the implications for vaccine immunogens? Should we use this to think that, in fact, maybe we should focus on GAG? Should we take these data and say, oh my God, is inducing envelope-specific responses actually exactly what we don't want to do? Or, in fact, is this just kind of another one of these in vitro assays that has no real relevance and we just have to kind of keep thinking about new assays to develop? And I certainly would be a proponent of trying to develop new ways to look at antiviral function of immune responses, and I'm not sure this is the best. And then finally, what are the implications for vaccine testing? Do we need to look at responses that are being generated? If we've got a way to measure neutralization in terms of cellular immune responses, should we be measuring that with vaccine candidates to try and understand what's going on? These are laborious assays to do, but we've been able to get them very highly reproducible. We're working with Jill Gilmore to develop this with IAVI for a vaccine, high-throughput assay for vaccine testing. And I guess I'll stop there and just want to acknowledge Huabiao Chen, who's the postdoc in our lab, postdoc of mine who's been working on this. We've had help from a couple of other labs at the Partners AIDS Research Center, Marcus Altfeld's lab and Todd Allen's lab, and a lot of helpful discussions and collaborations from people like Eric Lander, Dennis Burton, David Watkins, Otto Yang, Jill Gilmore, Philip Goulder, and Jerry Kavadia, and funding in particular recently from IAVI to do these particular studies. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Bruce. I'm sure we have to have some questions. I know that Getty is the first one.
I have a question related to methodology. So you're expanding the cells with specific GAG and OMB epitopes and then looking at responses and killing of the virus. Is there a possibility that you're missing some autologous epitopes and envelopes so you don't expand the populations that might be most responsible for the killing at the time?
It's possible, and there may be some stronger responses in envelope that we're not able to detect. But we've done this with we know what the autologous epitopes are. We know that by ELISpot they have strong responses to these particular epitopes. So In fact, if you look at the expanded cells in terms of the ELISpot responses, there's no statistically significant difference between the envelope and the GAG-specific responses.
And if you look at the population of the virus that you're pulling these cells out of, is there any evidence that you have escape already emerging in the envelope epitope so that you would...
Yeah, and that's a good question as well, and we don't have evidence of that. So I don't think that's the explanation. It's interesting. There seems to be, to me, to be something fundamentally different between these envelope and GAG-specific responses, and I really have not understood, and I still don't understand it. But envelope is processed differently. We know that from Bob Silicano than GAG, and that may be part of the issue here. It may also be that mutability within envelope also makes a difference. But what I've shown you is taking some people who have circulating responses and trying as best we can to show what inhibits replication, we can consistently show that the GAG-specific responses do really well, and even though they have strong envelope-specific responses, we can't translate that into something that shows us inhibition in vitro.
I have a number of points that I would
like
to...
We have 4 minutes to vacate the room.
Yeah, but just, a few points that I think that are important. Still, I am, the opinion that it is very difficult to translate, data generated in chronically infected individuals and then to transfer in a preventative setting. Now, I think it would be important to mention that there is a paper also from David Watkins published in Journal of Virology showing that if you vaccinate monkeys with GAG or GAG plus ENV, the GAG plus ENV performs better than the GAG alone in terms of protection. That is the first point. The second point, I think that, I would be a little bit cautious with underscoring the potency of GAG, because as 100% of people with chronic HIV infection have GAG responses, and then the people progress in any case. Then I think that to say that GAG is protective and ENV is non-protective, I think it's really a risky call, because as I said, it's very hard or a minority of individuals have ENV-specific responses during chronic infection, but 100% they have GAG responses. Now, the last point is about the feasibility of this assay, because, for people like us and others in the field that have spent the last, 5-6 years to validate, an assay, which is the ELISpot, I think that in order to validate this assay is going to take a long time. I don't think that this type of assay can be implemented very easily when you have 200 volunteers with 15 determination per each volunteer. It's going to be very hard.
I think to take the last question first, I'm not advocating that everybody needs to have this assay done. I think, though, to take selected individuals that are getting vaccine-induced responses and try and look at something that reflects virus replication is something that just makes sense to me and that we ought to try and do. So I think it's not a field assay. I think absolutely you still want to see what the specificity is by interferon gamma ELISpot, but you want to know, as you're looking at these vaccines, I think it's really critical to know and to evaluate outcomes based on the specificity of these different responses that are being generated. And so I think that's one of the key issues here. Now you had some other criticisms.
Comment. Everybody has GAG responses. Yeah.
Bruce,
and
you
everybody
reply very quickly, or you have a conversation after the meeting.
Okay. Well, we'll talk after. That's
okay,
fine.
Peggy, you. Okay.
Bruce, David Watkins' work also, I think, has raised that with the SIV model in which they've depleted the CD8 T cells from chronically infected animals and looked at the responses and come back when control was reestablished, I think has brought up the question, you can measure a lot of things in vivo, but maybe immunodominance is keeping us, even with CTL vaccines.
from or with looking at activity of CTL is picking up what the right CTL responses are. So in both David's work and in Otto's work, they also sort of have emphasized not just GAC, not just looking at envelope, but also thinking about NEF and the fact that immunodominance and perhaps proteins expressed earlier in the life cycle might in fact be the place to go to target and to get activity that might be better, CTL activity that might be more focused and better able to control things, control HIV replication. You've commented really on the differences between GAG and envelope, and I think that mirrors your studies. But have you, or do you know these other, anyone else that's tried to use these assays to look at GAG versus NEF versus proteins?
Yeah, we're doing that now, and I think other people are adopting these assays also to look at that. In terms of early proteins, in fact, what David's study shows is that, in fact, from a CTL standpoint, GAG probably is the earliest protein because it's preformed when it gets into the cell. And can within 4 hours of a cell being infected, it can be targeted by GAG-specific CTL, whereas envelope-specific CTL come up about 24 hours later. I think there are other issues that are involved here as well in terms of trying to think about, the fact of chronic infection and there are a lot of immunoregulatory mechanisms that are at play here as well, PD-1, CTLA-4, et cetera. So it's a complicated pattern. I'm just trying to be provocative here, I think, in terms of saying that, we've developed a whole antibody field around the ability to neutralize virus. I'm showing you some provocative data that say that we can do the same thing for CTL. We can elute out those specificities, and we can see something that's really striking in terms of the difference. What does that mean? I don't know, but I guess we as a field have to address that.
And I think that just because ELISpot's so much effort has been invested in looking at ELISpot assays, I think we still have to acknowledge that maybe measuring the wrong thing, or that assay, even though it's very doable, may not take us as far forward as looking in a smaller scale.
Well, I think, again, the ELISpot assay tells you something very important because I think it tells you the specificity, and I think what these data suggest to me is that specificity matters.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So thank you to the four speakers for great presentations, to all of you for great questions, for staying until 6 o'clock. Have a good evening.